Good evening and welcome to Indie Radio News, the weekly radio news program from The Independent, a free progressive monthly newspaper and online news site based here in New York. We cover social justice movements and the issues they are fighting for, both here in the city and around the world. We are your hosts, Elia Grian and Lydia McMullen-Laird.
Beginning with headlines. Success for NASA. A spacecraft designed to burrow beneath the surface of Mars landed on the red planet today after a six-month, 300-million-mile journey and a perilous six-minute descent. Flight controllers at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, leapt out of their seats and erupted in screams, applause, and laughter as the news came in this afternoon. It was NASA's ninth attempt to land on Mars since 1976. All but one of the previous U.S. touchdowns were successful. By examining the interior of Mars, scientists hope to understand how our solar system's rocky planets formed and why they turned out so different. Mars cold and dry, Venus and Mercury burning hot, and Earth hospitable to life. And in Ukraine, lawmakers voted today to impose martial law to fight what its president called growing aggression from Moscow. This came after a naval confrontation off the disputed Crimean Peninsula this past weekend, during which Russia fired on and seized three Ukrainian vessels. Russia and Ukraine continue to blame each other in the dispute, which has been ongoing since 2014. That's when Moscow annexed Crimea and threw its weight behind separatists in eastern Ukraine, with support including troops and weapons. And there is outrage in immigrant communities across the United States. This after agents fired tear gas on hundreds of migrants who tried to cross the U.S.-Mexico border. They were trying to get through the fence and wire that separated the two countries. American authorities shut down the nation's busiest border crossing in Tijuana, where thousands are waiting to apply for asylum. The situation devolved after the group began a peaceful march to appeal to the U.S. to speed up the processing of asylum claims for Central American migrants. Trump administration officials are defending use of tear gas against the crowd, which included women and young children, reiterating its long-standing position that the caravan poses an unusual threat to national security. Caroline Murray with the New Sanctuary Coalition says that the Trump administration is pushing to see how far they can go.
There are people who are being ripped from their homes and from their families every day from our communities, and people who are being disappeared every day by ICE, people who are going to their check-ins and not coming back out of that door. And so what's happening at the border is just a representation of what's happening every day in our communities. But what people do need to know is that we can stand up and impact what's happening and change the policies. And Sanctuary Caravan is a call for people of conscience, people of faith, people to stand together. And you can go to the border. You know, there's multiple ways to participate. Whether you can go to the border and meet, witness, and accompany people. And if you cannot, then you can create an accompaniment group back home to welcome our friends as they arrive and assist them in getting through the process and their asylum claims once they arrive at their destination. We have opportunities to participate online. We have trainings available. And so this really is a way for everyone, regardless of where you live or what your background is, to be able to participate in this moment. If you can, we have all kinds of tools available on the website for people to join at this time. And in this moment to really call out these policies and stand together and say, no, we will not let this happen in our name.
Murray says the caravan may seem far away from New York, but attacks on immigrants are happening right here in local communities.
There are people who are being ripped from their homes and from their families every day from our communities, and people who are being disappeared every day by ICE, people who are going to their check-ins and not coming back out of that door. And so what's happening at the border is just a representation of what's happening every day in our communities. But what people do need to know is that we can stand up and impact what's happening and change the policies. And Sanctuary Caravan is a call for people of conscience, people of faith, people to stand together. And you can go to the border, you know, there's multiple ways to participate, whether you can go to the border and meet, witness, and accompany people. And if you cannot, then you can create an accompaniment group back home to welcome our friends as they arrive and assist them in getting through the process and their asylum claims once they arrive at their destination. We have opportunities to participate online. We have trainings available. And so this really is a way for everyone, regardless of where you live or what your background is, to be able to participate in this moment. If you can, we have all kinds of tools available on the website for people to join at this time. And in this moment to really call out these policies and stand together and say, no, we will not let this happen in our name.
Caroline Murray with New Sanctuary Coalition. You can find them at newsanctuarynyc.org. Meanwhile, a U.S. Customs and Border Protections commissioner says during the confrontation where agents fired tear gas, 69 migrants were arrested on the California side of the border after trying to cross from Tijuana to the U.S. He says the Border Patrol's use of force policy allows agents to use tear gas, but that the incident will be reviewed. And there's been some movement in the high-profile case of Julian Assange. Federal prosecutors are fighting a request to unseal an apparent criminal complaint against the WikiLeaks founder. In papers filed today, prosecutors argued that the public has no right to know whether a person has been charged until there has been an arrest. Assange has been staying in the Ecuadorian embassy in London since 2012 under a grant of asylum and has long expressed fear of a U.S. prosecution. A hearing on the motion to unseal is scheduled for tomorrow morning in Alexandria. WikiLeaks tweeted, "Today, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who vowed to take down WikiLeaks as CIA head, has formal meeting with Ecuadorian Foreign Minister in Washington, D.C. Earlier in the year, the U.S. made loans to Ecuador conditional on handing over Assange." And in Mississippi, police are investigating two nooses and six signs that were found on the grounds of the state capitol today, a day before the U.S. Senate runoff between Republican Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith and Democrat Mike Espy. Hyde-Smith, who is white, has drawn fire for a photo showing her wearing a replica hat of a Confederate soldier and a video showing her praising a supporter by saying, "If he invited me to a public hanging, I'd be in the front row." The remarks drew sharp criticism in a state with a 38% black population. Espy is seeking to become the first black U.S. senator from Mississippi since Reconstruction.
In other news, Donald Trump is rejecting a central conclusion of a dire report on the economic costs of climate change. It was released Friday by his own administration. The National Climate Assessment warns that national disasters are worsening in the U.S. because of global warming. It says warming-charged extremes have already become more frequent, intense, widespread, or of long duration. The report notes the last few years have smashed U.S. records for damage weather, costing nearly $400 billion since 2015. Trump says, "I don't believe it." Trump administration officials and elected Republicans frequently say they can't tell how much of climate change is caused by humans and how much is natural. This despite widespread consensus in the scientific community that human activity, such as the burning of fossil fuels, has contributed significantly to climate change. And in local news, Democrat Andrea Stewart Cousins, representing Yonkers, has been elected leader of the New York State Democratic Conference. She will be the first woman leader of the New York State Senate when the 2019 session begins in January. She was first elected to the Senate in 2006 and has led the Democratic minority since 2012. Now that Democrats control the Senate, they are predicting passage for several bills long blocked by Senate Republicans. They include protections for abortion rights, legalization of recreational marijuana, and voting reform. New York Attorney General Barbara Underwood tweeted, "Another glass ceiling shattered, and not a moment too soon."
Cons- Concerns about the impact of climate change are growing, and advocates of a Green New Deal led by New York Congresswoman-elect Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez say that a massive investment of public funds in renewable energy, retrofitting homes, and expanding mass transit is needed to transition to a low-carbon economy. Last Tuesday, the youth-led Sunrise Movement held a day of action around the U.S. calling on congressional Democrats to back Ocasio-Cortez's call to establish a select committee for a Green New Deal. Here in New York, Sunrise activists visited the Lower Manhattan office of Congressman Gerald Nadler and presented personal statements to his staff, urging him to join Ocasio-Cortez, as well as New York Congresspersons Carolyn Maloney and Jose Serrano, in endorsing the select committee. This is Sunrise activist George Mentz.
We need to show elected officials that they are not anonymous and that we will hold them accountable. Their silence will not protect them. We know where they are, we see them, and we're going to make sure that everyone knows they are accountable for what they do or do not do.
Ocasio-Cortez's plan for a select committee currently has 14 endorsers in Congress. We're joined today by Kate Aronoff, contributing writer for The Intercept, to talk more about the Green New Deal. Kate, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we've been hearing a lot, especially over the past week or so, about the urgency of implementing a Green New Deal and whether that's politically feasible. No legislation has been written yet, but first let's start by talking about what is the Green New Deal and what's the difference between this Green New Deal and the one that Jill Stein talked about in her presidential bid in 2016.
Right. So on a basic level, a Green New Deal is a plan to transition the U.S. economy off of fossil fuels and at the same time to build up massive amounts of renewable energy. So as you mentioned, sort of massive investments, both in building up things like wind and solar power, creating more capacity for that in the electric grid, and doing things like expanding mass transit, public housing, a sort of whole suite of investments. It's kind of an umbrella policy under which different sort of programs can fit, like the original New Deal.
And why would this be a game changer? What about having a Green New Deal right now when we're getting all these reports out about, you know, having 12 years left until there's really we really start to feel the effects? What about it would be a game changer?
So I think what's really remarkable about this is that this is a really concrete plan for the first time, actually, to actually enact a Green New Deal. So the select committee would be tasked with convening with activists, with policy experts, with business leaders potentially, and really crafting a legislative agenda that could be introduced in 2021 after the committee has convened. And so this would essentially set us on a path toward actually having a Green New Deal, which is something that people have been talking about for a while, but hasn't really had too much teeth behind it.
And I want to talk for a minute about how the Sunrise Movement and all the actions we saw last week and Ocasio-Cortez have impacted this conversation around the Green New Deal. There's a lot of social media action, a lot of activists involved. How can that kind of showing on social media and in the media in general impact these conversations?
I think it's really brought it into the mainstream. And as someone who has been covering the climate policy debate for a long time, it's really incredible just to see how quickly it shifted the conversation away from these sort of half measures, sort of weak carbon pricing proposals to, you know, what the science is increasingly clear we need, which is an economy-wide mobilization to get us off of fossil fuels.
And, for example, the Sunrise Movement and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez staged a sit-in in Nancy Pelosi's office. How do you think this kind of pressure might impact her bid for Speaker of the House, if at all?
Well, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Sunrise have been clear from the sort of start of these protests that they do really, you know, to quote Ocasio-Cortez, have Pelosi's back if she wants to do this, and really supported the very idea of bringing a select committee online. And so the folks who are really challenging Nancy Pelosi's leadership bid from the right of the Democratic Party are the same people, not uncoincidentally, who are challenging the idea of a Green New Deal as being too ambitious and, you know, more than we can possibly hope for.
So what do you think are some of the obstacles that Ocasio-Cortez might face with creating this select committee? Where is that pushback going to come from? A lot of the Democrats have funding that's coming from the fossil fuel industry. So what do you see as kind of the things that's going to be in the way of the, both the SLIC committee and the Green New Deal?
Right. So for the, I mean, in the short term, the pushback coming from the Hill, from Democrats in particular, is sort of around issues of process, and Democrats arguing that this committee would undermine the authority of existing committees, which it really wouldn't. And in the sort of broader sense, I think the real pushback will come from the fossil fuel industry, who, you know, poured over $100 million into defeating ballot initiatives that were, you know, a fraction as ambitious as the Green New Deal in the midterm cycle. So I think we really yet to sort of see that. But if this committee gets underway, I think that will definitely come out pretty quickly.
Can you explain that a little bit more, the sort of conflict between existing committees and what this new committee would bring?
Yeah, and I think this isn't a totally coherent argument on the part of the folks making it. But the idea is that, you know, if we have these sort of existing committees that are empowered to make decisions on things like ways and means, energy and commerce, and a Green New Deal would theoretically fall under that. But what the advocates I've been talking to who are pushing for a Green New Deal have said is that, and I think rightfully so, that a Green New Deal is encompassing of several different committees. And so there really needs to be a body that has a purview which can encompass, you know, every sort of aspect of the economy, really. And so there isn't an existing committee set up to do that. And notably, they have not said, you know, that this legislation that would be produced would bypass any of those committees. So I think it's really kind of a non-argument.
So I want to shift for a second to local impact. How would something like this, if this Green New Deal does go into effect, how would this look on a local level? What would happen in New York, and how would people here be affected by it?
Yeah, for one, I think we could, you know, finally fix the MTA would be one real benefit for New Yorkers of a Green New Deal. Really investing in mass transit, making our public transit system truly sort of as great as it should be. Another would be potentially fixing the sort of massive problems that have plagued NYCHA for years and years, and really, you know, turning our public housing, which is a real resource of the city, into, you know, expanding that, and, you know, making it truly sustainable, you know, making it a place where people really are excited to live, as public housing is in so many other countries. I think beyond that, you know, could extend accessibility to other parts of the state, to other cities, and really just make sort of life in the city much better. And, you know, in New York in particular, about 60% of the state's emissions come from buildings. And so I think there'd be sort of, you know, a massive number of jobs to be had, retrofitting those buildings, making them really sustainable, and sort of stopping that real leakage of carbon in the atmosphere that comes from our buildings.
And what about the sort of racial inclusion and racial justice issues and the equity issues that people talk about surrounding these types of policies? Can you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, and I think the folks who are pushing for a Green New Deal are very, very clear that the original New Deal did not go nearly far enough and actually, you know, really discriminated against people, particularly communities of color, in the programs that were a part of it. And so sort of first on the agenda, and this is in the kind of resolution to establish the Select Committee, is to make sort of targeted investments in communities that have been historically disinvested from. So, you know, things like making clean energy really accessible in a way that it currently isn't, extending transit networks to communities that have been excluded from them, really investing in housing and all sorts of things which could really sort of dramatically improve the lives of millions of people, including, you know, not to mention job creation, which would, you know, this could potentially generate millions of jobs around the country. And so I think that's, you know, something that's sort of on the top of the mind of folks who are coming up with this plan.
And finally, there's a lot of people who question the feasibility of actually making this happen. Do you think there's enough momentum and enough political will to pull this through?
Absolutely. And, you know, we really don't have an alternative at this point. So, you know, the country has come together before to take on challenges that have seemed really incomprehensible. You know, we fought off the Depression and created a welfare state, fought World War II, you know, went to the moon. So we've done all of these things which, you know, seem totally crazy when the idea was first floated, but that, you know, very quickly just became a fact of life. And so I think a Green New Deal and really taking on the climate crisis, the scale the science demands, is no different.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Kate.
Thank you so much.
That was Kate Aronoff, contributing writer of The Intercept. You can follow her at Kate Aronoff on Twitter.
Welcome back to Indie Radio News. You can find us every Monday at 6 p.m. on WBAI 99.5. In the second part of the show, we go to the Delaware River that touches the states of New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware. Almost 16 million people get their drinking water from the river. Some states, like New York, have taken steps to stop fracking. Governor Andrew Cuomo banned hydraulic fracturing in 2014, but still allows the importing of shale gas and has kept the CVP power plant in Orange County open. To keep the Delaware River under collective and balanced control and to ensure its fair usage, the Delaware River Basin Commission was created in 1961. Earlier this year, the commission proposed banning fracking in the basin. To talk more about this, we have Eric Weltman, a Brooklyn-based senior organizer for Food and Water Watch, a nonprofit environmental organization whose mission is to oppose corporate control and abuse of resources. Hi, Eric. Can you start us off by explaining exactly what fracking is?
Fracking is a very dangerous method of extracting natural gas and oil, which we successfully banned in New York after a many-year campaign to pressure Governor Cuomo to do so. And now we're trying to extend that ban throughout what's called the Delaware River Basin, which is a region that embraces four states, which is a source of drinking water for millions of people. And so Food and Water Watch is very concerned about protecting the Delaware River from fracking and fracking-related procedures.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the current threat is right now and how you are dealing with it?
Absolutely. So Food and Water Watch is laser focused on trying to encourage Governor Cuomo to be a real climate leader. Having banned fracking, we now want him to move New York off fossil fuels completely by opposing all fossil fuel infrastructure, all fracking related processes, as well as shifting New York off fossil fuels to 100% renewable energy. So Food and Water Watch is encouraging Governor Cuomo, along with many other allies on the Delaware River Basin Commission, to not only ban fracking, but any and all processes related to fracking, including dumping highly toxic fracking waste, as well as banning the withdrawal of water from the Delaware to be used in fracking.
Cuomo actually, in 2014, he banned hydraulic fracturing in New York. Do you think that measure was enough?
More than 5 years of organizing and advocacy and agitating by a massive grassroots movement, Governor Cuomo did indeed take the first step by banning fracking itself here in New York. We believe that he needs to do a lot more to be a real climate leader, including stopping all fracking-related infrastructure, the pipelines, the power plants that transport and burn dirty oil and dirty gas, as well as banning fracking waste in the Delaware River Basin, as well as across New York, and moving New York off dirty fossil fuels to 100% renewable energy. So good first step, Governor Cuomo. Glad you took that step 4 years ago, but you need to do a lot more.
How does fracking affect the day-to-day lives of the 60 million people who use the water as their source for drinking water?
The threat of contamination from fracking waste that could be dumped in the basin, in the region, as well as the promotion of fracking by withdrawing water from the Delaware River. We don't think the Delaware River and fracking go together in any way, shape, or form.
Why is it that people don't want to stop fracking? Who's benefiting from this?
The oil and gas industries and those that they contribute to. I mean, that's another, you know, important, you know, campaign that our friends at Sunrise are spearheading, which is to get, you know, any and all fossil fuel money out of politics. And that would certainly help matters a great deal.
Representative Ocasio-Cortez and the House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi have been strong advocates for transforming New York into a Green New Deal. Do you think that's possible? And what's the level of urgency to do that?
The science is clear that we need to move New York and the nation off of fossil fuels rapidly and justly. The technology is there. We can do it. What we're lacking is the political will. And thankfully, what we're seeing, you know, both in Albany and in D.C., is a lot of new blood and a lot of awareness, you know, given not only, you know, the evidence documented in a host of studies, but people can see the urgency around them. And all the, you know, the wildfires across California, all the storms.
Thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you for listening. You can catch us every Monday at 6 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 FM for all the latest from Indie Radio News. You can find this month's print edition of The Independent at our outdoor news boxes across the city and in local libraries, independent bookstores, and social movement centers. Follow all our latest coverage online at independent.org, that's Indie with a Y, and via social media. To let us know what you think of today's show, send news tips, or find out how to subscribe to The Independent's print edition, we can be reached at 212-904-1282 or contact at independent.org. Thank you so much to WBAI for hosting our show, and see you next week.